In the news.
Good morning. I'm Professor Shaw.
And I'm Professor McDaniel. Welcome to In the News for American and Texas Politics.
So week three, y'all have had your first exam, and we're going to turn to the content, the second set of modules for the course. A lot of it is going to deal with institutions like the Congress and the presidency and the courts. A lot of stuff in the news. Professor McDaniel and I kind of set our agenda on Tuesday, and then on Wednesday, all hell breaks loose, literally, in Washington. Let me just mention the kind of lead story prior to the D.C. shooting at the baseball field, which occurred yesterday morning. The lead story prior to that was Russia, as it has been for quite some time. And I want to make a point about election hacking. Some of you guys may have seen this. Bloomberg News came out with a report on Tuesday that, quoting sources, saying that as many as 39 states had some Russian hacking efforts directed towards them during the 2016 election cycle. And this was taken up by pundits and journalists talking about the sort of infiltration of the Russians, and I think playing to this notion that the election itself was compromised. And one thing I wanted to say about this issue before we start talking about some of these other things that happened last week is that I want you all to be aware, apropos of our conversation about federalism in the United States, one of the things that's interesting here is that the fact that we have such a federalized system, such a non-unitary system in the United States, actually helps us with respect to our election systems in the following way. You could go in and hack, and by the way, don't do this, but you could hack the Texas state, the Secretary of State's website. You could hack the voter file, the official voter file. You could go in and change votes. By the way, you can't, but if you had the capacity to do that, it wouldn't affect any election outcomes in the state of Texas. Now, why, you might ask? Because ballots are aggregated at the county level. They are simply reported to the state. So the state, in the case of American elections, is basically just a bean counter. All of the action occurs at the counties. So in Texas, you're talking about 250-plus counties. So good luck to the Russians, trying to hack into Deaf Smith or some of these other small counties. In fact, some of these counties don't have websites, to hack. And they certainly don't have online server-based repositories for their election information. It's not mandated by the state of Texas. And so all I want to say here is that, the media needs to distinguish between hacking and election manipulation. If you're sitting out there thinking about, well, what exactly happened in 2016, Shaw, I would say that the focal point is that the Russians are trying to mess with us, to delegitimize the system. The Russians also, we think, facilitated the WikiLeaks, which was a hack of the DNC's server, and they kind of, WikiLeaks systematically put out these emails that were sent by higher-ups in the Democratic National Committee, the formal Democratic Party. They would sort of leak these emails, internal emails, from one person to another. And a lot of this stuff made it look like the Democratic Party was putting its finger on the scale during the primaries to help Hillary Clinton and to hurt Bernie Sanders. That was embarrassing, and that was sort of negative news for Hillary, leaked slowly throughout October during 2016. That could have been consequential, because that played into a narrative that she was part of the system and maybe dishonest, even though it wasn't her, it was these Democratic officials. That, I think, is, kind of a legitimate concern about affecting the dynamic and the narrative of the election campaign. The more specific claim that, hey, election systems were hacked and votes were changed, it didn't happen. It just flat out didn't happen. It's not that it's impossible. It's highly improbable, and it certainly is no evidence whatsoever that anything like that happened in this cycle. So just wanted to make a distinction between, when they talk about hacking a state election system or a state website, that doesn't mean that votes were manipulated, and so we don't know whether the count in Michigan or Pennsylvania. Forget about that. That's not what we're talking about. But I also don't want you guys thinking that Shaw said the Russians had nothing. No, man. I've seen Rocky IV, right? I know what the Russians are capable of here. I grew up during the Cold War. And Putin, sorry, I don't editorialize much in this class, but Putin's probably not a very good guy. So I think we're all, as citizens, concerned about this sort of activity. But there's a difference between meddling and stuff that's really concerning, especially as we look forward to the future about the Russians messing with the legitimacy of our electoral systems. There's that, and then there's actually manipulating votes. And the former occurred, the latter did not. All right, so just want to mention that up front. Now we're going to talk a little bit about the D.C. shooting that occurred yesterday. So, Professor McDaniel, where were you when this went down? Did you hear about it on TV?
Actually, I received an email because one a UT grad was actually one of the victims. So he was shot. I believe he's. Right. I'm not sure the extent of the injuries. I know he wasn't killed.
He tweeted afterwards from the hospital and said he was okay.
So I knew nothing about it. So I was meeting with students, doing a whole bunch of other stuff. When I found out about it, I looked at it. Each year Congress has a baseball game. So it's Republicans versus Democrats. The money goes to charity. So it's basically a way to kind of play up on partisanship, but in a positive way to give back to charity. It's something that happens every year. And so they're practicing for the game because, again, you don't want to lose.
And you don't want to look bad.
Yeah, you don't want to look bad because there are cameras out there.
You don't want to throw like this. And
yeah, you don't want to be that the candidate who throws out the first pitch like 50 Cent or Snoop.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah, it just doesn't look good. Or with your jersey tucked in like Michael Wilbon.
You untuck. By the way, advice from us. You get the first pitch opportunity, untuck jersey. Don't tuck it in.
Yeah, you're not 80. Even 80-year-olds don't tuck it in.
Yeah.
All right? They had like a 100-year-old throw out a first pitch in Boston. He didn't tuck it in. If a 106-year-old has more swag than you, then you really need to check yourself. But going back to this, so in particular, one of the key individuals there was not just staffers, but the Republican Party whip, Representative Steve Scalise from Louisiana, was one of the victims. He was shot, I believe it was shot in the hip.
Yeah, he was actually playing second base.
Yeah.
And was one of the initial targets, yeah.
By the way, just to make
sure everybody's on the same page with this, this occurred I heard some reports say it was in Virginia. My assumption was that the baseball field was
it
in.
It may have been Alexandria. Yeah. They were saying Alexandria, Virginia.
Okay. So these Republican team was out practicing early in the morning. They get their practice in and then, beat traffic into the district and get back to Congress. And apparently this gentleman wandered up. If you guys have been to a baseball field lately, it's usually only one entrance. Everything's locked down. I think that's especially true in D.C. and in Northern Virginia, where there aren't many facilities, right? They don't, God forbid, people would play on their field. But it's relevant here because apparently, this guy wanders up and asks, is this the Republican or the Democratic team? Someone says, it's the Republican team, and he opens fire. And what Professor McDaniel was saying is Scalise, who's, again, the Republican whip, and you guys will see this as you get to the Congress lecture in the second set of modules that we've released. It's essentially the third-ranking position in the House of Representatives. A whip is someone who goes around and counts votes. So Scalise was important in the counting of votes for the repeal and replace on Obamacare. He has a pretty good reputation. But the key thing here is that Scalise is entitled to a Secret Service detail. And if he had not been, if the whip had not been on the team, there would have been no protection, no secret. I said Secret Service. It was actually the district police, I think, were there. So we had two police with him. Those police were the ones that took down this crazy guy and shot him. But otherwise, you'd have had all of these guys, and I presume some women too on this baseball team, who were trapped on a field that's locked. And it could have been carnage. We were saying you could have had 10, 15 congressmen and congresswomen assassinated.
Staffers,
aides, could have been killed. So as awful as it is, it was actually a little bit fortunate that it wasn't a lot worse, right? But it speaks. Of course, people on the right are talking about this is a reflection of Trump derangement syndrome and people who are just over the edge. People on the left are talking about, this is a gun issue and that Trump has fed into this hatred. And our sort of take on this, Professor McDaniel and I say, it's like, just why don't y'all shut up with that for a little while? Why don't we just kind of let's make sure people are okay. And then we can have a discussion of the larger policy implications,
The thing about it is, while there were, the only person who was killed was the shooter, you have to remember his community. He had family members. They've lost somebody, and they have to now answer like, what was this person doing? Then on top of that, you have the individuals who were the actual victims. And so they have to process what happened to them. This was a traumatic event. And so to immediately politicize the issue, it can come off as very distasteful. And given how gun control is such a hot button issue, people are kind of jumping on this immediately. If you go to various websites, they're like, look, you know, we're averaging a mass shooting, you know, almost every day. And sometimes you're like, okay, you know, but you have to realize these are real people going through this. And so before you start getting to these debates about, you know, what should happen, what should not happen, let's remember there are real people at stake here. There are real lives at stake. And I think that's what gets lost in this, is that we spend so much time arguing back and forth about ideology. We forget that there are actual people that are involved, and we just treat them as kind of chess pieces on a board as opposed to actual human beings. And so because of this, you can see a lot of disenchantment coming from the public with the response to this from on the left as well as on the right.
Yeah. Just a couple of local notes, localized notes. Roger Williams, who's a representative from sort of near the Austin district, where Austin is carved up into three districts, and Roger Williams is one of the representatives. He may be, you know, for those of you who are living in Austin, he may be your rep. He actually used to play, was a pitcher at TCU, and I don't know whether Williams was at the practice. I know he's on the Republican team, and I believe one of his legislative aides was like on deck or might have even been taking batting practice when this occurred. So there is this, as well as Professor McDaniel mentioned, this UT student, a former UT student who was also involved in the practice and was one of the people who was injured. So there is this sort of local connection, too. And, you know, so our thoughts and prayers go out to the UT student as well as everybody involved in this. But we wanted to sort of transition. So we talked about, you know, kind of Russians in the election. We've talked about this D.C. shooting. But Professor McDaniel, as we were kind of cooking up what we were going to do for the In the News segment today, wanted to tackle the broader issue of populism. And it plays into this because populism, as you guys have probably heard it portrayed in the media, speaks to leaders who kind of appeal to the masses and reify or you know, honor kind of the common people. But it's not that easy a concept sometimes. And I think Professor McDaniel has kind of some interesting slide that he put together to kind of get to this issue of populism, which plays into the climate in Washington and the rise of Donald Trump and these other things. So you want to take a whack at that? Do we have, first of all, let's make sure we get the slide up for the students who are watching.
Yeah, so so we think about populism. People talk about President Trump, but also Bernie Sanders as using populism. And we know this individual was a Sanders supporter. And so let's actually talk about what populism is. And populism, again, this is a definition that's been used quite a bit. And it comes from a book titled Populism, A Very Short Introduction. And the definition is a thin-centered ideology that considers society to be ultimately separated into two homogeneous and antagonistic groups.
That's a mouthful.
Oh, yes. That's a bunch of big dictionary words right there. That's SAT words right there. The pure people versus the corrupt elite. And which argues that politics should be an expression of the general will of the people.
I'm sure. I wish I knew what thin-centered ideology meant.
I'm glad you asked that question, because yeah, I actually do have an answer, because I had to look that up myself.
I don't feel quite as dumb.
So one of the things about it is people talk about populism. Some say it's a strategy. Others say it's an ideology. This definition really says it's an ideology. It's a collection of beliefs. But the thing about populism is that it doesn't really tell us much about, okay, what do we do about the economy? What do we do about foreign policy? What do we do about social issues? And that's what they mean by a thin ideology, in the sense that it's really an idea of really the way government should work, but really doesn't tell us, okay, what should we be doing? So if you think of nationalism, if you think of socialism, things like that, there are very clear statements. Okay, here's how the government should carry out the day-to-day things. Here's how we should handle the economy. Here's how we should handle social issues, things of that nature. So what we say by, again, being a thin ideology is that's usually coupled with another ideology. So if you think of Bernie Sanders, his was kind of a socialist populism or a liberal populism in that regard. And so he actually gave a speech where he defined what socialism is. So if you can look that up. He gave a speech at Georgetown about that. Like, look, let me make it very clear to me what I mean by being a socialist. But in addition to this, one of the things about populism is that populism is really divisive because it makes a moral distinction between the people and the elites. And again, the key thing here is a moral distinction, meaning one group is good, one group is bad. All right, it's very anti-establishment in the sense that you don't, again, the elites are the establishment, you want to push them out. And this is extremely important, but also relies on emotionalism. And again, if you think about really the reaction of the Bernie Sanders supporters as well as the reaction of the Trump supporters, there's a lot of emotions running high with these individuals. Because again, it's a fight between good and evil. Then furthermore, because it's pitted as a fight between good and evil and this idea of these evil elites out there, it's open to a lot of conspiratorial ideas with the idea of the elites working behind the scenes. So when Professor Shaw talks about Noam Chomsky and elite theory, I mean, this is this idea that the elites are working behind the scenes. Because again, the elites are seen as a homogeneous group, the pure people. And the key thing here is the pure people. And so you run into this problem of who exactly do you mean by the pure people? And this is extremely, now, what we say is the antagonist or the clear antagonist of populism would be something such as elitism, where elitism argues that the elites are good people, are good, virtuous people, whereas the masses are just vulgar and ignorant. Populism kind of flips that. One of the things that's important to note is that while people have talked about, you know, Trump supporters and kind of how emotional they've been and how they've taken part in some activities that people are not, that are somewhat controversial, we also need to remember that Bernie Sanders supporters were that way as well. So for everybody who says, you know, Bernie Sanders supporters, are all, this is a love fest, well, there are a lot of DNC superdelegates who have messages on their answering machine which would speak to the contrary. Furthermore, if you think about how many of the Bernie Sanders supporters came after black leaders, where, you know, there are plenty of messages like, what's wrong with you? You know, you stupid minority, vote for your interest. I mean, there's a lot of this, because again, it's an emotional thing. Again, it's good versus evil. All right. And so they saw support for Hillary Clinton as supporting evil. All right. So that's a key aspect of it. But then the last part about this, and again, this is why, part of the reason why it's seen as a thin ideology is that it's really a set of ideas about how politics should function, not how government should function, but how politics should function, and an emphasis on popular sovereignty in the sense that everything should be the will of the people. The problem you run into this is, again, if you go back to this, the pure people. So who exactly are the pure people? So when Bernie Sanders is using his populism talking about the people, who is he talking about? When Trump says this, who is he talking about? But the idea of populism has been coming on for a while. If you think of the Occupy movement, or we are the 99%. This argument, like the 99% are the pure people, the 1%, the people working on Wall Street, these are the unruly and evil or corrupt elite, you know? And so I think the New York Times had like an Occupy protester and somebody on Wall Street actually sit down and have lunch to kind of explain, like, no, here's what I do. You know, and so one of the things about populism is that it does. Now, some people argue that populism can be inclusive, that it can broaden the idea of who are the pure people who should be included. And this is an argument that's been used when populism is applied in Latin America. They say in Europe, the populism is usually exclusionary, where it's coupled with an idea of nationalism of, you know, not just are the elites corrupt, but these individuals that are in the nation that should not be in the nation are corrupting the nation. And so populism, it works. You know, you see this going on at the state level, you see this going on a lot, but populism is very antagonistic. All right, and so because it's antagonistic, this is why you're gonna see Trump supporters behaving one way, because they buy into this populist ideal. Same thing with Bernie Sanders supporters. And so populism, you know, it's a strategy, it's an ideology, and it has been beneficial in some ways, making sure that the people are getting their voice heard, but it has its drawbacks. And anything that's done to organize people, a lot of times it's pitted as us versus them. And when you have us versus them, the key question you run into is, okay, who was the us, then who was the them? And you end up demonizing individuals. So President Obama has talked about this quite a bit. I don't know whether this 2008 campaign talked about how we need to stop demonizing individuals. And if you remember after the shooting in Dallas where 5 police officers were killed, President George W. Bush had a great quote where, you know, we see the best in ourselves and we see the worst in others. And this becomes really a big issue about demonizing these other individuals. And populism is, you know, you are demonizing these people. And populism is going to exist no matter what, but it's important to be aware of the fact that populism exists. There are some good aspects to it, but there are also some bad aspects to it. One of the things that's important with any ideology, with any strategy, that there are benefits and there are burdens. There are trade-offs that you make. And so you must be aware of not just the good, but also the bad. And so that's kind of what I'm going to talk about, because, you know, I want to talk about populism before this even happened, but this kind of demonstrates really one of the negative effects you get out of populism. Now, one of the good things about it is Trump and Sanders were probably able to get individuals who didn't normally vote to get out and vote. Say, you know what? No, I have something to say. But at the same time, they have these certain individuals who took it too far. And then one of the things that it also points to is, I think the Washington Post and New York Times pointed out that one of his neighbors was like, well, I didn't know much about him. He was a Democrat. I was a Republican, so I really didn't talk to him. And it talks to this bigger idea of how the two parties have demonized each other so much. But then on top of that, you have people demonizing, you have party members demonizing each other. And so you just see this increased fractionalization of the nation. And we need to ask ourselves, what is the public doing? What are the elites doing? What is the media doing? And what can we do to kind of solve these problems? Because in many ways, the problems or the gaps between the two parties are not as big as we make them out to be. There are many policies that the Republicans have that Democrats would agree with, many policies that Democrats agree with, but we automatically say that, well, you're the them, and so I immediately distrust you. And in many ways, you could argue that populism, under certain circumstances, may feed into this. That's a very long speech about that, but I want you to make sure you understand when people talk about populism, what exactly populism is. Because we use a lot of terms out there, we throw a lot of terms out there, and they're used sloppily, especially by the media. They're very sloppy in the use of their terms. We want to make sure you understand exactly what this term is. And so when somebody talks about it, you're able to clearly state, no, this is what this is. This is exactly what this is about. You're using it incorrectly.
You know, it's one final thing on populism, and then we'll roll on to a couple other topics, is someone who studies political parties, and both Professor McDaniel and I do that, and it's a particular area that I concentrate in. Populism, traditionally in the United States, in terms of substance, is comprised of two different sort of policy, I guess, nodes. One aspect of populism is social conservatism. That is, most populists, this is not true of Sanders supporters, which is why in some ways he's not a typical populist candidate. But the idea is you go back to Long, you go back to Coughlin and some of these other figures from populist movements in the United States historically back in the late 1800s and early 1900s, they tend to be socially conservative. That is, they appeal to religious values and traditional sentiment, and they also tend to be economically liberal. So what they really come in and advocate for is government intervention on behalf of the little guy and the little guy's values and traditions and morals. And so it's an odd substantive space that they occupy in American political conversation. We think of Republicans as socially conservative and fiscally conservative. We think of Democrats as liberal on economic issues and liberal on social issues. Populists are different. They're liberal on economic issues, usually, and conservative on social issues. And so you see a lot of populism in the South, traditionally, where there's a lot of religious sentiment, there's a lot of conservatism on social issues and values issues and race issues. But there's also, a great appetite for investing in infrastructure and programs that put the little guy to work. Right? That's, Lyndon Johnson in a lot of ways, although this changes as he gets older, but early on, there's a lot of populism in what Johnson advocates. So, anyway.
George Wallace would be another great example.
George Wallace is a great example. As I said, I used Huey Long in Louisiana. So, it's something that's, a lot of you guys are from the South. It should be familiar. Okay. And we wanted to also talk about a couple other things. The Federal Reserve rate has raised interest rates to between 1 and 1.25 percentage points. This is something we'll talk about when we deal with economic policy later on, but we wanted to note it here. It's an indication. We won't get into what the Federal Reserve is. Stay tuned for, a future module coming to an internet cafe close to you. But it's a way of what the Fed does is it influences the money supply. How much money is sloshing through the system? And when they want to control the money, they raise interest rates, right? Because interest rates are connected to borrowing. If they want more money in the system, they'll lower rates so people are borrowing money. If they want to kind of slow the money that's sloshing around in the system, they'll raise interest rates so it's not as easy to get capital and to acquire money. When they raise rates, that's an indication they're concerned about inflation. They're concerned about the economy overheating, right? So they kind of tap the brakes a little bit. This isn't much of a rate increase. You know, it's to between a point and one point. I guess we looked it up, a point and a quarter. But it's more significant than it has been. They've been slashing interest rates for years after the 2008 economic crisis to try to get investment going, to try to get people borrowing, to try to get money into the system. This is one of the first times when the Fed has actually increased interest rates, which means they think the economy is back on sound footing, and they're actually more concerned about things like inflation than they are about economic growth. So, you know, just something to note. For those of you who are thinking of buying a home, interest rate, you know, the lower the interest rates, the better.
Yeah.
That's something Professor McDaniel and I know all too well, I think. You know, it used to be back in the day, you know, you didn't invest necessarily in stocks. You could put your money in a certificate of deposit or a government bond. Mm-hmm. But recently, the rates of interest are so low, there's almost no return. You might as well put your money under a mattress, right? You know, it's possible that over the next couple of years, if the economy actually comes back, that would be an investment option, you know, for you all. As interest rates rise, then these, you know, kind of low yield investment strategies become an actual possibility. I mean, right now, the stock market is going so gangbusters, you'd be crazy to put your money even into a savings account. If you get more than a fraction percent interest rate on your savings account, you're doing pretty well. I need to check that, by the way, because, you know, I've got one of those and it ain't doing much for me or my kids. All right. You got anything on interest rates or?
I mean, the key thing about it is the chair of the Federal Reserve is Janet Yellen. She was appointed by President Obama. President Trump was critical of her. However, he has warmed to the idea of renewing her appointment. But even if he does renew her appointment, there are other positions that are open. And so President Trump will actually play a very key role in shaping the Federal Reserve over the next couple of years. I want to say there are at least four slots open. And so he will appoint these individuals for the Federal Reserve. And so there may be a bit of a fight over that. I know some of the Democrats have already written letters opposing some of the names that have been floating out there.
This gets back to this question about populism, where the Federal Reserve system, which was put in place in the early 1900s, and again, the actual contours of the system are described both in the text and they'll be described in the economic policy slides and lecture that we'll deliver later on. I think it's in the third set of modules we'll release. So we won't go into detail right now, but the Fed system was put in place, you know, in the 1910s or so. It's a multi-member board, and what they do is they really dictate what the banking system that's backed by the federal government, federally insured. All of those are member banks for the Federal Reserve System, and the Federal Reserve Board basically sets the terms upon which they participate in this, you know, federal banking system. And part of it is the reserve requirement, how much money you have to have on deposit. Part of it are interest rates, so the rates that you're charging for consumers and people taking out loans. That's why the Fed is so important, because it sets the tone from on high and it filters down to all the member banks, and, you know, that's why we care about this kind of stuff. And, you know, people who don't like Wall Street and think the Fed was part of the problem from the economic crisis, they're very concerned about, well, we're all concerned about these appointments. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't lose a lot of sleep over it, but people in the Occupy movement, in the, you know, in the, you know, trash Wall Street kind of mentality are, you know, they would prefer to have a much more kind of aggressive, dynamic Federal Reserve system that isn't, you know, connected as much with Wall Street. So let's move to, we're going to move to kind of our rapid fire potpourri session here at the end today. Professor McDaniel, you want to talk a little bit about the Kansas experiment, right?
All right. So let's talk about Dorothy and Toto. Kansas is one of the states that, when you saw kind of the Tea Party come into power, Kansas is one of those key states. And Governor Sam Brownback, when he was elected, basically said, you know what, we're going to get rid of a lot of these taxes. We're going to cut down on a lot of our social spending.
This is like 2010?
Yeah, about 2011. Yeah. Okay. And so he comes in. And he actually says, like, this is going to be a big experiment. So he clearly says this is going to be an experiment. We're going to show you that by reducing taxes as well as reducing spending, that people will, one, not be so dependent upon the state, and that we will see economic growth. That has not happened. And what you're seeing is that in a lot of areas that that Kansas actually had a, where it had a budget surplus, now has a shortfall, where it's had to borrow money, and also it's been underfunding things such as education to the point where the Supreme Court ruled that it was not spending enough, and this was that it violated the state's constitution. And what you saw most recently happen is that the Democrats, as well as some of the moderate Republicans within the Kansas state legislature, basically brought back some of the taxes that were there. So it took basically a push against Brownback, who's actually calling for more cuts, and said, no, we're going to reinstate some of these taxes because the state is just not operating properly. And one of the things that the state did to try to overcome this shortfall is they raised the sales tax. But many people have argued, well, and the sales tax is classically referred to as a regressive tax because it actually hurts poor individuals more so than others. So while they're paying at the same rate, the idea is that if I make $10,000 a year and I pay, you know, $700 for something, it means that means more to my bottom line than if I'm making $100,000 a year. And so it's also argued that poor people are more likely to buy products that receive a sales tax, whereas there might be tax breaks for people who buy wealthier things. And so this is seen as kind of being more and more regressive towards the poor, where you're seeing, again, the lack of expansion of Medicaid. And so, like, the Washington Post kind of talked about this one particular family in which the mother makes too much, like, the grandmother's taking care of three grandchildren. She makes too much to qualify for Medicaid, but not enough to qualify for, but not enough money to where she could receive the subsidies through the exchange system, through Obamacare. And so this has become one of the major issues. You're seeing a lack of funding for the schools. And so you're really seeing this kind of pushback. You're seeing the same thing happen in Louisiana, where after former Governor Bobby Jindal stepped down, the new governor came in, a Democrat, basically saying, look, we have such a huge shortfall, we may have to shut down the universities. And so everybody's like, no LSU football? Oh, my God. And be true, we saw last season, it'd probably been better off. Roll Tide. All right, but the key thing here is there's this really big pushback. And again, Brownback said this is the experiment, and people say, okay, is this proof that the experiment failed? Again, it's been several years of this, and you're seeing several states, I think Kansas, Indiana, Louisiana, Oklahoma, are kind of examples of where this experiment failed. Or people are believing the experiment failed or didn't work the way they thought it would. And so many people are actually arguing that by lowering taxes, you're not actually going to create an economic boom. And, you know, if you look at this Washington Post piece on the Wonk blog, there's actually making some comparisons. And again, people want to say compare like California to Kansas. That's not really comparing apples to apples. But there has been some work by economists who try to group states by similarity. And what they've argued is that with all these tax cuts that the Kansas economy has actually lagged as opposed to move forward. Because one of the problems you've had is they haven't been able to build the infrastructure. So they haven't been able to repair roads, things of that nature. And so, you know, a strong infrastructure brings in strong business. They haven't been able to do that. But moving on to Kansas,
Let me go. Potpourri for 200, Alex. I'm going to go for an article in the. I used to read these things all the time. It's actually a newspaper. So I was checking this out on Tuesday, and there were a couple great articles. I thought we're talking about the media in some of the lecture modules this time around, and a couple things I wanted to mention. I found this article, PolitiFact. PolitiFact is a, you know, kind of a truth. Truth in Media outlet that the Statesman has a version of, the Austin American Statesman, which is a local paper. And it's an interesting study for those of you interested in trying to figure out how the media covers politics and, you know, can the media do something about fake news or contribute to, in a positive way, to our understanding of, you know, how to make sense of the world. So I thought there was an interesting piece here. It says there was a claim by Maram Mesatif, who is a newly elected member of the Austin City Council. She's confirmed in 2017. And she had a statement. Ms. Mateef said, I'm very familiar with Central Health's mission. So she's talking about sort of the health organization that the City Council overrides, and the needs of the people we serve. I bring a broader representation to the board. Moussatif went on, Austin has a growing Muslim, Arab, and refugee community, and they need a voice at the table. I can be that voice. I'm a Muslim and speak fluent Arabic, which is the third most common language in Austin. So PolitiFact, I want you to think about this, PolitiFact decides they're going to test that statement. Is that statement true? Now, do I particularly care about this statement? I don't know, but I think it's interesting that they would choose to fact check that statement. All right, so how do they fact check it? Well, they go about eight paragraphs in talking about people at the Central Health and what language people speak when they go to the hospital. And it's not until about the eighth paragraph that I found the following. Jewel Jordan, a Census Bureau spokeswoman, responded to us by pointing out the results from a single year, as if this changes, you know, minute to minute, 2015 American Community Survey for Austin, indicating that behind English and Spanish, the third most common spoken language was Chinese. According to the results, Arabic was Austin's 12th most common spoken language. I find this a fascinating. So they rate her statement as mostly false. Now, I find this whole thing totally fascinating. Why would you choose this? This is a city councilwoman who has a fairly innocuous statement. It's basically English, Spanish, and then everything else. But the question is, okay, amongst 3rd to 12th, where does Arabic fall? And then it takes them 8 paragraphs till they do what any researcher would do in the first 5 seconds of posing this question. Call the Census Bureau. Ask the Census Bureau, what data do you have? They said, oh, we do this massive community survey, and in fact, we find that Arabic is 12th, Chinese is 3rd. You know, why did it take you that long? Well, okay, the media has to build a story. Professor McDaniel saying they were kind of building drama into this thing, which is totally true. So I found that fascinating, that they could have dispensed with this whole question with a single paragraph that should have been the lead paragraph, but that's why I'm not in journalism. But then I also started thinking about their scale. Their scale runs as follows. True, somewhat true, sort of half and half. Somewhat false, false. And you think, okay, that's a balanced scale, right? Two negatives, two positives, a middle category. Ah, but then they have the pants on fire category. All right, so she doesn't get pants on fire, but why would you have an unbalanced scale skewed to the negative with a pants on fire rating as opposed to, I don't know, what if you balance it, it'd be like, what, angel wings or something for your truthfulness?
Pants on fire is also... It's a normative statement of like, oh, no, you're flat out lying.
So I just find this interesting. So I am not, as you, and I'm in the minority on this, very much in the minority. Most people love these PolitiFacts and truth checks. I question the sort of things they choose to study. I question the way in which they assess. There's no set standard. What are we talking about? Are we talking about kind of general intent? Are we talking about the actual letter of the statement? And then the scale is screwed up. I mean, just from a basic political methodology standpoint, you can't have 3 negatives and 2 positive ratings and claim, you know, this thing is clearly set up to be, and I like Gardner Selby, who does this for The Statesman. I know him a little bit, and he's called and asked on a couple things. I'm sure he's called Professor McDaniel, too. But this thing is clearly skewed to the negative, and I'm not a big fan of that. I think it contributes to the sort of cynicism and skepticism about politics. So my other thing, Justin, this is my last thing. In the same newspaper edition, the Metro section, I got to read you this. As I said last week, I don't read often, but this was great. San Antonio. Sure, we have some San Antonio people out there. Elected a new mayor, and this is my favorite paragraph of this last week. The new mayor is Ron Nirenberg. You know, he won in not really an upset, but it was unusual. He doesn't have a long history in politics. Here's the key paragraph. Sandwiched between meetings, Nirenberg got in a workout. A former bodybuilder, he is arguably the physically strongest mayor San Antonio has ever had. On Sunday, he knocked out multiple sets of back squats at 315 pounds, which, by the way, is pretty impressive. At a victory party the day before, campaign officials told the crowd about the feats of strength Nirenberg had accomplished. With the physique not unlike the cartoon character Popeye, Nirenberg has a small can of spinach tattooed on his inner forearm. That, my friends, is not fake news. That is all you need to know. So, feats of strength is now becoming an important part of politics. I welcome this development. So,
Adler ain't got nothing to get. Yeah, Adler won't be able to hang.
That's great. I think we should just move straight to, essentially doing back squats at 315. that's how we should figure out who's going to lead us.
Yeah, I mean,
I got no problem with that.
We ain't going to, well, the Russians do dope.
Well, yeah, that's why Putin's in charge of Russia at this point. But okay.
So the last thing to talk about within the state of Texas is something you may not have really been that concerned about, but it's kind of interesting. And that deals with eyebrow threading in the state of Texas, that the state of Texas now no longer regulates that. And so, but in addition to this, the state of Texas also gotten rid of regulations on the need to get a license for shampooing hair, as well as for companies to put boots on cars. And this has really been a big push within this, amongst a lot of people in the state to say, look, you're kind of killing businesses by asking for all these licenses. And it really started with the eyebrow threading, because people say, no, you got to go to cosmetology school, which can cost up to $18,000, take about a year to complete. And so this is a lot of money spent. And really, the amount of time in cosmetology school that's dedicated to this is very small. And so you could argue, well, maybe it's a hygiene issue. Like, no. Hygiene is consistent no matter what. So you have to keep your area clean. You have to do certain things. Hygiene is consistent no matter what. But why exactly do you need a license to do eyebrow threading? And so they actually challenged us in the state Supreme Court. The state Supreme Court ruled in favor of, ruled against the state. So the state could no longer enforce this. And so the state just, in the last legislative session, got rid of that, but also chose to get rid of some other regulations and other things in which require people to have licenses. Now, many people see this as, okay, great, by deregulating this, you're allowing businesses to flourish without having government intervention, but there's also a trade-off to this in a sense that when the government required licenses for some of these things, it actually was able to generate millions of dollars of money. And so the state is losing funds in regards to licensing fees, with the hope being that through sales tax and these business activities, the state can get these funds back. But we will have to see. But this is kind of one of the interesting things that come out of the legislative session, and really see kind of certain things that are happening that may have, you know, an impact on you that you may not have realized.
All right. We're done for the week. Thanks for your attention. Pay attention to the announcements. I'm going to post an announcement, send out an email about some of the logistics in the course. Otherwise, stay safe, stay out of the heat.
Yes.
Get in the air conditioning, get into a pool somewhere, and enjoy the modules. We'll talk to you guys next time.
The Government 310 in the News podcast is hosted by Drs. Darren Shaw and Eric McDaniel, and is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio and the Department of Government and the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.